about. So you've got one of the great delights of being a president is that you develop a very close relationship with the chair. And well, Jan of Archer's here, and he and I had a have still. It hasn't finished. Just because I've resigned as president, you've resigned as chair. I resigned. Doesn't mean it ends. But we got very, very close, and I'm really pleased that Surya Gupta and I are working so happily and well together. We seem to click very easily, and completely different background and so forth to me. But it's absolute delight. And thank you all very much for turning up. Your confidence in me is very touching and slightly slightly awe-inspiring. I feel less clear about what I'm going to talk about than I've ever done before. Now, I'm clear about what I want to talk about, but I'm not clear how I want to talk about it. I may turn out to have been clearer than I thought I would be, or maybe not. One day it's all going to go wrong and I just walk out and that'll be that, but the rambling days will be over. The starting point for my thinking is I want to explore further some things I talked about at the funeral of our teacher Ogyen Sangharakshita. I think probably most people will know that Sangharakshita Urgyen Sangharakshita is the founder of our order, and that he died just 3 weeks ago. And we're all, well, not, it's not coming to terms with that at all. We're all just, it gives us an extra dimension of appreciation of who he was and, in a sense, who he still is. But it fell to me to give a eulogy, an elegy, 15 minutes, it's an appalling task. It I felt was the sort of the most important talk of my life in a way. Mm. I had to try to say the right thing at the right moment, and I did pretty well actually. I'm quite pleased with myself. I had about 2 hours worth of talk, and I had to condense it down to 15 minutes, and I came away feeling I hadn't really said what I wanted to say, but actually on reflection I said what needed to be said. But there are some thoughts that I had in that process that I want to unpack a little further somehow. I said a little bit about the conundrum of the Sangharakshita phenomenon, that he combined this absolutely awe-inspiring understanding of the Dhamma, penetration of the Dhamma, and sort of radiation of the Dhamma with a human personality that at times I found not altogether easy to relate to, and that certainly at times led him to do things that some people felt harmed them. And so I, over many years, had to sort of struggle with that. To begin with, I just thought he was, you know, completely unquestionable, and everything that he did was completely perfect, and if it seemed wrong, it was because of the limitation of my understanding. I've come to a somewhat more sophisticated grasp of the matter, and I think in that grasp of the matter, it's extremely important and interesting things which have a very direct bearing upon each of us as individuals. And I think probably my ability to understand Sangharakshita in this way, I was going to say two sides, I can't talk about two sides to Bhante, it's multi-dimensional, but these two aspects, I suppose, the human being living within space and time, and this bodhisattva who lives beyond space and time, and in being able to come to terms with that, I think what I first had to do was come to terms with myself and my understanding of myself. And I'm going to try to explore that a little bit. I'm not going to, fascinating as I am, it's the most interesting topic I know, but I doubt if all of you will agree with me. I want to explore a little bit of what my own process of trying to come to terms with who I am has been, because I hope that will be will reflect upon you and your own experience in different ways. I think I can say that I've always found being alive pretty tough. I've had a very good life, a very easy life. I was extremely privileged. My parents were very good to me. They were very solid, stable. They were middle class. My father was a naval officer, senior naval officer. My mother was a New Zealander, which was pretty difficult. You know what New Zealand women are like. I have to get that one in
You were lucky.
there. No, she was a very good mother. Although I have complained a lot, I've really nothing to complain about in retrospect. It takes some time to, of course, like all of us, to get into a more mature relationship with my own parents. But I never had to struggle in my life. They always had enough money. They weren't rich, but they always had enough money. I had a very good education. I was sent to a boarding school. For those of you who are foreigners, it's what English call the public school, which means actually a private school. It's a conundrum that none of us can quite understand. Goes back to 18th century gentry customs. But my parents made a lot of money for me to get an excellent education and very poor food and cold showers every day, and very cold rooms too. I was very unhappy at school. But in terms of the externalities of my life, I've been unbelievably privileged. No door has closed in my face. I've never experienced any prejudice against me, really, until I came into the movement and met working class Glaswegian order members, for whom I was not only the class enemy, I was the national enemy. It's a joke, but not quite a joke. In other words, I began to come into contact with people from a much wider range of backgrounds, and all the sort of difficulties that arise from that, and the interesting things that arise from that. So yes, it's when I say that I found life a struggle, certainly not externally. I've never worried about money. I've never feared for my safety. I've never felt that I could not handle life. But I guess that where the struggle has been is in relation to other people, and in finding my relation to them in all sorts of ways. Some of those I'll maybe try and unpack, because I think they're the useful material. And of course, with myself, trying to work out who I was, what I wanted from life, to trying to come to terms with the inner tensions that simply being alive generates. And again, I've been very fortunate externally that I encountered Buddhism at a very early age. I encountered the movement when I was 21, and I was ordained when I was 25. So I've been extremely fortunate that I've been in contact with a very great individual and a very great teacher, and been present in the foundation of a sangha, and been able to participate very fully in that and to contribute to it. But I'm now 70. I'm nearly 71, just to push it right to the limits. And I wish I knew back then what I know now, just when it's about too late. I wish I'd worked out much more clearly what it was to be me, right way back, because it always a really painful struggle to kind of clarify what's going on, why people are reacting to me, why they don't do what I want them to do, why do people see me like this, why do I do that, why are my intentions misunderstood by me as well as other people. I can't say I've sorted it all out, but I'm just a lot clearer now about who I am, and much more at ease with that. And I think this is the art of life, isn't it? Really, is coming to terms with oneself in all one's dimensions. And I want to try and unpack some of those dimensions as this rambles on. But yes, it takes a life to unpack all these different elements. And coming from the generation that I come from, it probably, in some ways, more acute for me than it may be for you, although, everyone has their own acuteness. My parents were very conventional, middle-class citizens, white, very confident of their place in things. My father, naval officer, very confident of their class status. And Britain had just emerged from the Second World War. We won it. Little bit of help from the Americans, and I suppose the Russians did something. But that wasn't the feeling. The feeling that we won it with Churchill. I remember sending Churchill sixpence for his 80th birthday. And that was the sort of mood of the times, that we'd done it, we'd won. And it's a very, very positive atmosphere in that sense, even in my early days of in Britain, a strong sense of the solidarity of the war years. And Britain was still a very, at least to my eyes, a pretty homogeneous a society. It was almost exclusively white. The Windrush and all that came when, 60s, 50s, 60s? Yeah. Hardly saw a black face. And if one did, it wasn't sort of a, there was no, not an opposition to it for my generation, for my class and background. Homosexuality didn't exist. I only began to discover about homosexuality when I went to public school. Not because public school was a rampant homosexual paradise for those who like that sort of thing, but because there was a terror of it. And the house that I was in, there was a spy system. You lot would have been out before the beak. They were making sure it didn't happen. So it was just something that was feared, and there was a horror of. Interestingly, my father had a completely different attitude. Well, he was a naval officer, wasn't he? I remember when I was going off to school, he said something like, "Well, if some of the older boys get interested in you, it doesn't matter." But that wasn't the attitude when I got there. So yes, it was the Sexual Offences Act was passed in 1967. That was when homosexual acts between consenting adults over 21 was decriminalised. So for 20 years of my life, homosexuality was a criminal act. I went to the same school that Alan Turing went to. He wasn't there when I was there, but famously he was arrested in the 1950s and forced to take chemicals that basically castrated him. The cultural environment was still very, very traditional. I remember when I was at school discovering that one of my fellows at school, his parents were divorced, and I was shocked. Divorce did not really exist in our sort of circles, if you see what I mean. And there were even sort of questions about whether my parents should associate with somebody who was divorced. So I'm just trying to give you an idea of what a huge transformation's taken place within my lifetime. And it's got faster and faster, hasn't it? I wasn't really aware, I wasn't aware of homosexuality, and I didn't sort of really begin to accept homosexuality until I came into the movement and really begin to accept that homosexuals were quite normal people. That it wasn't something sort of a choice or a lifestyle option or something like that. It's just something that happened, that you were just born like that. And only very recently, really, I began to realize that, the cows in one field and the bulls in the other doesn't really sort of cover what's going on. It's much, much more complex than that. I still don't really understand how to think about, what the whole discussion about non-binary. Completely accept that's what people understand, what people experience, but it's a mystery to me. I haven't experienced that at all. It's always been pretty straightforward. Not absolutely straightforward, because of course, growing up with a fairly uncomplicated understanding of myself as a man, the main thing was I enough of a man, and would I be able to get a woman and be a man with a woman? But other than that, it was a pretty straightforward matter. Now, there were two doors, you went through this one or that one. Actually, it was in the movement that that began to sort of become, as a matter of experience, something much more fluid and nuanced, and began to know people as individuals, and then whatever their proclivities or their background was, followed on after that. For quite a long time, the movement was almost exclusively middle class, white, English. And, for a while, there was a bit of a tension for black people coming in. I remember Surya Gupta is the one who really sort of opened my eyes there, because I had a really good human communication with you, which made a huge difference to me, because it's through the human that you come to accept the diversity of things, if you see what I mean, because it's just getting to know different people and their different backgrounds. I do remember resisting in myself some of the conditioning that I received. I went to the local state primary school from when I was 5 to when I was 10, when I went to a boarding school, a prep school. And I remember when I went to the school, I must have been a little bit later, about 7. My mother, who actually came from pretty egalitarian New Zealand, but she'd had to sort of adapt to English class system. I remember her saying to me, "Look, you're with these people now, they're your friends now, but remember, you're different from them." And I remember the thought going through my mind, "No, I'm not." But of course, I can't say that I didn't take that in. But as a child, you go by your experience, and these were my friends. I didn't feel different to them. Yeah, they might have had broad Kent accents, and I had, well, actually, I had a broad Kent accent, but I also was moving in an atmosphere of the Queen's English. The question of accent in England, as some of you will know, is very class based. Later I came to try to disguise my accent, which was pretty obvious to everybody. Very bad Cockney accent I used to have, but I can't resist telling a funny story. Not so long, about 15 years ago, I went into a bank in Birmingham to open a building society account. And there was a very nice woman behind the counter, black as it happens. We had a really nice flirt, as one does. Innocent flirtation through the screen, as it were. And after a while, she obviously really enjoyed her contact with me. And she said something like, "I'm not going to try a Birmingham accent, though I'm sorely tempted." It's so bad, it usually sounds like South African. But anyway, she said something like, "Well, where do you come from? I'm not familiar with your accent." And I nearly drew myself up to my full height and said, "Madam, this is the Queen's English." Anyway, I put myself down pretty quickly. Yeah, that's the first incident that I remember my mother trying to sort of indoctrinate me with a class system, which she hadn't been brought up with, but she'd sort of tried to fit into, I suppose, perforce. My father wasn't particularly like that, but she sort of tried. Then later, my father, when he left the British Navy, had a job in Nigeria. It's a end of the colonial period, and he went to found the Nigerian Navy, interestingly enough. And it was over the independence period, so for a while he was under the colonial authority, and then for a while under the independent government, which he really enjoyed, actually. My father just loved his job and liked to do it properly, and if that was the system, he fit with it. But again, I remember I had a canoe, and we lived on the edge of a lagoon, and I used to go across the lagoon, and there was a village across there, fishing village. And I got friendly with a young lad my age. I remember his name even, Taidu. He didn't speak a word of English. I didn't speak a word of Yoruba. But we sort of got on and enjoyed each other's company. He laughed at the way I paddled the canoe and that sort of thing. He thought I was really funny. I really enjoyed it. And then my mother started to get a bit nervous and sort of said, I don't think you should be really associating there. And again, I thought, why not? But I'm trying to indicate where the conditioning that I came from, what it was like, and the distance that people of my generation have had to travel. And I'm not therefore surprised at so many of my generation voted for Brexit, because I've been privileged to live in a sangha where I have friends from huge range of different backgrounds. Most people, they're terrified of this huge change because they haven't learnt what I think, or what I'm going to try to talk about us having to learn, which is coming to terms with your conditioning, coming to terms with it, and coming to a new relationship to it. A relationship that does not deny it, but at the same time does not appropriate it, if you see what I mean. For instance, as an Englishman of a certain generation, literally when I was first beginning to learn geography, the map was red. The whole map was, well, what was it? The empire on which the sun does not set. And there was still an Empire Day. India had become independent just 4 or 5 months before I was born. I always say this in India, don't blame me. Africa was still very largely, the colonies were still under colonial rule. Malaysia, many other countries were still under colonial rule. And it was a source of sort of pride that we were the rulers of the universe, if you see what I mean. Well, it's a proportion of the universe. And I think one of the things that my generation had to come to terms with was that it wasn't as simple as that, and that colonialism had many, many evils, and that Britain has, been in some ways a force for good, has also in many ways been a force for bad. And so then one has to come to terms with one's national identity and sort out, well, as Monsieur Macron said quite recently, nationalism from patriotism. I think he said some very wise words, actually. To learn that it was okay to love my country, to love its scenery, to love its the best in its culture, to love the fact that it even is a multicultural society today. That it's been able to be that partly because of some of the good things that it's inherited from the past, Magna Carta onwards. So it's made me this sort of long perspective, these changes that I've had to go through and still going through in relating to a very rapidly changing world around me, which is changing more and more rapidly because of essentially because of the technology that we have available that completely changes our relationship to the world. I didn't see a computer until, it was after I wrote Buddhism for Today, so 1980s. I was one of the first people in our movement to get a computer, which was a 68 kilobyte memory. Can you think that small? It took about half an hour to warm up and that sort of thing. a floppy. So you know, you cannot believe just how the. I'm sure you can, but you know how that has changed the way in which we experience the world around us. And people like me will never quite occupy the same as people like you who've been born into that realm. We can never do it. It's always a little bit alien to us. Anyway, I can go on and on, and I'm getting a little carried away. But I've realised that over the course of the years, and it's perhaps particularly in the last 10 or 15 years, I've sort of come to terms more and more with who I am and become more and more easy with it. And so I want to step back and get a little philosophical about this. We're all of us something particular. You cannot be everything in general. You cannot be what you're not. I can never not be English, if you see what I mean. Even if I got another passport, I tried desperately to get a New Zealand passport, but I was born 6 weeks too late. Too early, sorry. Sexism in the New Zealand government. But even if I had another passport, I'd still be English. Actually, my mother's a New Zealander of Irish and Norwegian extraction. My father was of Scottish extraction, but you know, come on, look at me. I'm English of a certain kind and generation, yeah? I can never not be that. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with that in itself. What's wrong with that is if I make that my identity in the wrong sort of way. So, what I mean by make it my identity, and perhaps here again I have to step back and just get a little philosophical. Identity, the word identity, is derived from the Latin idem, which means the same. So, identity is to do with, in the strict philosophical sense, is to do with, well, being identical, being something in particular, and not being something else. It's probably the most important aspect of Buddhism philosophically that it completely denies the notion of identity. There can be no identity. Because identity implies something fixed. It implies something that exists, so to speak, independently of itself, in its own right. That does not change. So, identity, for instance, would be applied to saying that I am the little boy who was born in Kent in 1947. I am that little boy, that I am identical with that little boy, that there's something about that little boy, a funny little brat that he was, there's something about that little boy that is the same as this old man sitting here now. That something about that is unchanged. Of course, there's a sense in which it is. I've got a picture of myself at the age of three, and I'm standing. I've got curly blonde hair. I've actually got hair, curly blonde hair, sort of lovely little boy. And I'm standing like this, and it's exactly the same as me, if you see what I mean. My character is written all over it. You can see I'm going to found a Buddhist center somewhere or other sometime. Or I'm going to found something. But, of course, completely different to me now. Literally, there's not a single cell that was in the body of that little boy there that I have in me now. I think I'm right. I'm looking at a doctor, just she's looking away from me embarrassedly. You know, even at that level, everything's changed. in so many other ways, I'm discontinuous. Well, rather, I'm not the same as that. So Buddhism, it really is all about recognizing there is no identity in the sense of something fixed that endures through time, that does not change, even if, you know, in philosophical terms, the accidents change, the externals change, the substance does not. In Buddhism, we'd speak of that as Atman. The fixed self does not change. But Buddhism, the central teaching of Buddhism, that just is not the case. And what Buddhism teaches is this, that identity, taken in this strict, more philosophical sense, is empty, it's void, it's unreal, it's artificial, it's constructed. And not only is it artificial, unreal, and constructed, it's profoundly unhelpful and leads to clinging, because you think there's something you can hold on to, and you can't, because there is no such thing that you can cling to. So you're going to suffer because it's passing away. So for instance, if I cling to the notion of Britain as you know, the ruler of the world, I'm going to be suffering pretty quickly, for instance. If I cling to notions of sexual identity that I was brought up with, I'm going to start suffering, and so on. So Buddhism is completely rejects the notion of identity. That's its central teaching, really. If it's nothing else, it teaches that. Everything else follows on from that, that the notion of identity, the notion of Atman, in this strict sense, is empty. What it does teach is continuity. That might be the best way of putting it. It's not that there's no connection between that little boy and this old man. There's a continuity of causes and conditions that flows through time. And so I inherit the deeds as well as the biological and cultural accidents that I was born with, if you see what I mean. I inherit them, but I'm not identical with that early self. And all the way through my life, I've been subtly changing. And in fact, at every moment, I'm really different. I'm really new. Strictly speaking, we should be able to sort of almost change our names day by day. I remember Bhante saying that once, that you know, when you become ordained, you're given a new name. And he said, well, strictly speaking, you should have a new name every morning. New every morning, isn't that a hymn? But anyway, because you strictly speaking, each moment you are actually new. There's a continuity with the past, but there's not an identity with the past in this strict sense. If one means by identity simply continuity, fair enough. But I think usually we bleed over the line, as it were, and identity in a looser, almost more poetic sense becomes mixed up with identity in a more philosophical sense. We identify with that, and we think that's what we are, and we cling on to it. And we cling on to it because we think that will give us security. And again, in the whole discussion of Brexit, which is a very many-sided issue, and I don't think everybody who wants Brexit is bad and awful and rotten, or everybody wants not to remain as good and wonderful. But one of the things we've seen in the mixture is the people terrified of loss of identity and wanting to reclaim an identity. And one must have sympathy with that, whilst not necessarily endorsing the means. I think it is difficult for people of my generation. As I say, I'm extremely fortunate. But I think for many, it's a terrifying, the rush of time. The changes are terrifying. I don't know, sometime I'd like us to address that in some way, perhaps by creating more sangha. But yes, this is the essential point, that In Buddhism, we teach no identity in the sense of no fixed reality independent of space and time. Something about us that does not change, and that is the true I. Complicated, because sometimes we use a language which is derived from, I suppose, the Romantic tradition of, you know, discovering myself and things like that, which has a genuine and positive meaning, but can very easily tip over into a sort of individualistic quest for identity, philosophical identity. But yes, Buddhism teaches no identity, and it teaches us that embracing that is happiness and freedom. But no identity does not release you from conditions, if you see what I mean. Accepting that you are not, you do not have an identity that's independent of space and time, does not free you from being at this moment a particular, because whatever exists in space and time has to be particular. Do you see what I mean? You can't exist within space and time and not be bound by space and time, because space and time are sort of limiting coordinates. You have to be there then, and if you're there then, you can't be here then. And that means you have to be something in particular. And I think the task for us as Buddhists is to recognize the particularity of our existence within space and time, and to come to terms with it, to accept that a lot of it is not our fault, as it were. It's not my fault I was born in Chatham in 1947, if you see what I mean. I didn't choose it, but, you know, if you think of rebirth, you don't really choose. It's a conditioned process that just unfolds in a certain way. There's a lot about me that is not in my control, not in my immediate control. I'm a particular sort of person, and that's not just down to being English, white, male, of a certain class, certain education, and so forth. It's a particular character. I respond to things in a certain way. I respond with my brain, first of all. I wish I didn't, but that's the first thing I do. Just, you know, I wasn't taught to do that. You know, people from my class and even my family do it differently. It's just something to do with mysterious forces. We don't really understand why we're so particular. Genetics come into it, obviously, but why do these genetics become associated with this stream of consciousness? It's a mystery. Ultimately, all these things are mysteries. But even the particularity of my character is not chosen by me. Of course, as life goes on and I make choices, I do affect my character, even affect my genetic structure. But the baseline, it's not really within my choice. I can't be blamed for it. I can't be blamed for being English. I can't be blamed for being male or bloody bloody blah, or a bit of a headbanger. Anyway, all those sort of things. And having certain blind spots, being a little bit insensitive in some ways, not really spotting certain things, not picking up certain things. You know, it's just the given. What I can do is take responsibility for how I handle that, if you see what I mean, how I am with that. How I relate to that. And how I act on that basis. Mind shooting off in all sorts of different directions, but that's what I can take responsibility for. I always think of this, there's a point in the career of the great Dr. Ambedkar the leader of the so-called Untouchables, when he realized that to gain real freedom, he had to leave Hinduism because the caste system was so integral to the Hindu religion. It's not really quite a religion, but the Hindu system. And he famously said, "I was born a Hindu. That was not within my choice, but I will not die a Hindu. That is my choice." And I think there's a lot in that, if you see what I mean. Of course, he was talking in a very particular way. So in a certain sense, I can say, I was born English, but I'm not going to die English. I don't mean that I'm not going to have a British passport or that I'm not going to love the soil of England. That I'm not going to love my language and its inheritance and so forth. What I mean is I'm not going to be bound by its nationalism, its the less desirable things in it, which is, I think, what Monsieur Macron meant by patriotism. And this is a well-known distinction. Nationalism is my country, right or wrong, and patriotism is I love my country enough to criticise what is wrong and to dissociate myself from what is wrong. So I can never stop being English. I hope I will never stop loving England, and I hope that I will never try to cover up the faults of this country and the bad things that it's done. I hope I will always, been done in its name. You can't say a country does something, but have been done in its name. I hope I'll never do that. Well, I'm sure I have, but I hope I will continue not to try not to do that. So I can take responsibility for being born in a certain situation, having a certain conditioning, by not clinging to it, and by putting it into relation to higher values, universal values, and then trying to use that identity, try to use that conditioning for the good. I can try to put it at the service of higher values. And actually, that is what I broadly tried to struggle to do for certainly 45 years of my life, and perhaps even longer. Certainly since I was ordained, I tried to do that, but just wasn't sufficiently aware, and probably still not sufficiently aware, of what that conditioning is, if you see what I mean. So I try to put it at the service of higher ideals, but I'm still clinging to bits of it. I'm still attached to bits of it. And I'm a lot less clinging to it than I ever was, but it's only comparative. I'm not trying to compare with anybody else, but compared with myself, I'm doing it a lot less. I'm sure I need to do it more. You know, for instance, I always know exactly what I think. And I'm always confident that I'm absolutely right. It's like I always know exactly where I am. My partner, to begin with, I was a very obliging person and used to, you know, I'd sort of say, "We go this way," and she'd just follow on after me. But after a while, I'd notice she'd sort of say something like, "Are you sure?" And of course. And then after a while, I'd have to pretend I hadn't done that and go in the other direction or something like that. But now I just have to say, I don't really know. So I've got absolutely infallible sense of direction. But the trouble is, it's fallible. If you sort of mean by sense, is that it's absolutely right. It's sort of built in. It's sort of somehow or other, partly from my cultural conditioning, partly from my parents. Both my parents were pretty self-confident and knew where they were and what they were doing. My mother could never tell left from right, and you always used to have to do this because that was left. But anyway, apart from that, they're pretty confident where they were and what they were doing. So I suppose I inherited that. So I need to think, what's the value in this particular character? What has it got to offer? How can I use it for the benefit of the greater good? How can I associate with others in such a way that My strengths are available and my weaknesses are covered. That would be the ideal. That's what Sangha ultimately is, that whatever, you know, by the accident of conditionality, whatever it is that I have that is useful is put to use, and whatever I have that's a bit unconscious or a bit weak or whatever is covered by others, and that I'm able to let them cover it. That, I think, is what Sangha really means, that you put yourself at the service of the ideal that the Sangha serves, so that your strengths are put to the best possible use and your weaknesses are covered. Sometimes there's no choice. There's only you, if you see what I mean. This is what Bhante says about himself, isn't it? That he saw that a new Buddhist movement was needed because the old Buddhism was running out. It didn't apply. Well, somebody was saying to me that, you know, in their own country, a Buddhist country or country with Buddhism in it, the Buddhism that is traditional doesn't really quite work for young people, doesn't match the younger generations, it's not explaining itself, it doesn't sort of relate to a modern sensibility. Bhante saw that. He saw that what was being done in Britain was over-intellectual on the one hand, and on the other was a sort of off-the-shelf application of traditional Buddhism that just didn't really work beyond a certain point, and certainly didn't work for a bunch of acid-dropping, dope-smoking hippies. He saw the huge need that there was and the huge opportunity that was. That's what struck him most, he told me, that he could see how this could unfold. He could see the opportunity. He also felt it was a very particular time. He said to me quite a bit later that he thought that the FWBO, what now we call Tri Ratna, could not have started anywhere else in the world than London in that period, because at that time it was an amazingly free and easy city. I don't think it'd be so easy to start the movement now here. He saw the need, he saw the opportunity. He also had been in India working with the new Buddhists who converted because of Dr. Ambedkar. And he saw that Dr. Ambedkar's understanding of Buddhism, very, very deep, but not very worked out. He didn't have time to work it out. And he'd not been through the process that Sangharakshita himself went through with the foundation of the order, which was a sort of working out of what it meant. And, you know, because the new Buddhists were coming from a situation of extreme deprivation and of oppression and marginalization, inclusion was a key factor for them, and gaining power and influence and having a voice was so important for them. So Buddhism got sort of filtered through that social, political need. It got diverted to some extent. I think Dr. Ambedkar was extremely clear about these issues, but it took time for his followers to connect with that. So Sangharakshita saw this need all over. He'd seen a lot of traditional Buddhism in India, mainly Theravada, but others as well. And of course, he saw Tibetan Buddhism, you know, being chased out of the whole context that really preserved it. Interesting, I've just been to Ladakh. We have a Dhamma Mitra who's from a Ladakhi background, in other words, Tibetan cultural background. And I met with a group of his friends in Zanskar, which is a valley cut off for 6 months of the year by the snow, and in which the sort of full living Tibetan Buddhism is still present. But I was meeting with him and a group of his other educated Ladakhis who've all been educated in, I can say in India, but of course they are Indians, and they were saying that, you know, they loved the Buddhism that they'd inherited, but they just couldn't kind of make it work. So they wanted me to talk on modern Buddhism. Cue for a song. I know what modern Buddhism is because I've been educated in it. I've been educated in a Buddhism that's fit for the modern world. So Sangharakshita saw this need and saw it very acutely and clearly, as everybody who's had any contact with him and or his writing, his thinking, knows. His exceptionally penetrating understanding, not just of the Dhamma, but of circumstances and situations. Misjudgments, we know, but for circumstances and situations, astonishingly clear-sighted. And he knew that something was needed, and he sort of looked around. Nobody there. Nobody to do it. The people who should be doing it were too caught up either with traditional Buddhism or caught up with politics or whatever. Nobody to do it. And his own inclinations were rather traditional. He's often said this, and somebody was telling me the other day, one of the last dreams he had was of himself, and several dreams he's had over some years, I remember him talking about this, was himself in a sort of monastery in the mountains. That's probably where he'd have been happiest, just studying the Dhamma, meditating, teaching in that context. But there's a need. He was the only one. And he knew that he was not the best person. He knew that he lacked many of the right qualities. So again, this sort of clear-sighted understanding, at least to some extent, of his own conditioning. And he accepted the task, knowing that in many ways his own personality was not the best. I think it was pretty good, actually. But it has left us with various conundra of all sorts. And like the one he mentions is that he's mainly interested in the arts and the humanities, not in the sciences. Doesn't latterly, actually, was until the day he died, he was reading up on quantum physics. But it's not his sort of background and natural way of thinking, not where he'd explored. So he was put in a position that probably all of us will be in to some extent, even if we're lucky enough to be in a really mature sangha, we'll all at times be in the position where our own conditioning does not suit us to the task and where we have to rise to the occasion. And it's that I want to try to explore tomorrow. I want to try to explore the interface between the particularity of our conditioning and our relationship from that conditioning with what transcends conditioning. How do we, as it were, channel, to use that overworked metaphor, how do we channel what goes beyond conditioning, within our conditioning, and within the conditioning that's around us? That's the task that, without meaning to, I've just set myself. How do we actually go about it? And I face this in India. I will never understand Indian culture. I can't. I'm not Indian. And it's in many ways a bit alien to me. I don't understand English culture anymore, but that's another question. But I'm able to give something there. So I have to understand the limits of my own conditioning in relation to that situation, which I don't always recognise, of course, but I have to be quick to notice where they're inadequate. So I want to try to explore that and explore a little bit more fully the ways of thinking about our conditioning in ways, actually, that Sangharakshita himself has talked about. So there we are. I've managed to fill an hour. I was a little bit worried about that, but I seem to have managed to talk myself out. I hope I haven't talked you out. Please do come back tomorrow and see where this fascinating cliffhanger leads her to. With one bound, he was out of the snake pit. That's what I want to try and see. How do we think about ourselves as conditioned beings, come to terms with it, and then how do we relate that to the ultimate, the ideal, what is not actually contained within that conditioned framework? How do we relate to that, and how do we live it out? And I should say right away that we do it hit and miss, more or less. And there is, in Buddhism, a whole discourse about perfection in that, which I'll try and come on to. It's another topic I talked about in my little eulogy. That'll do for now. Come back, otherwise you won't know how to deal with your conditioning.